Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's inauguration of Vladimir Putin, who, after having ruled Russia for the past 12 years, begins a sixth and possibly 12-year term. Joining us from Moscow is Masha Gessen, a Moscow-based journalist and author of several books, including her latest, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She is one of the organizers of the demonstrations that took place on Sunday and Monday to protest Putin's fraudulent election and the continuing reversal of freedom, transparency, and the rule of law in Russia. Then we'll examine the fate of a Republican statesman, Senator Richard Lugar, who is about to lose his re-election in Indiana to a Tea Party candidate who is being funded by the Club for Growth and other right-wing super PACs. Marjorie Hershey, a professor of political science at Indiana University in Bloomington, joins us. We will discuss the implications of Senator Lugar's possible defeat by outside money in a campaign that denigrates statesmanship while demanding more conservatism. Then finally, we'll speak with Sister Simone Campbell, the executive director of NETWORK, a Catholic social justice lobby. She was recently criticized by the Pope for promoting radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith and not pushing church teachings on abortion, contraception, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood. We will discuss the fate of Obama's healthcare reform that she has championed and Paul Ryan's theology. And joining us now is Masha Gessen, who is a journalist and author of several books. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate, among other publications. Masha has served as editor of the Russian language magazine Snob and lives in Moscow. And she's the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Masha Gessen.
Thank you.
And the inauguration of Vladimir Putin took place today in Moscow with lavish ceremonies and followed by an even more lavish banquet, all in the throne room of the former czars. It's beginning to look like this is a modern-day czar, is it not? We've had Putinism for the past 12 years, and we're now set for another six.
Or, as he hopes, 12. I think the remarkable thing about this inauguration is not what was happening inside the hall. There's some things that are interesting about what was happening inside the house as well. But what was happening outside, you know, Putin was driven through the inauguration ceremony through completely empty streets. Not a single person in sight. Because they had shut off even pedestrian access to the streets along his route. In addition, they had cordoned off the Kremlin. Some parts of the Kremlin just for the last couple of days. Some parts of the Kremlin actually for the last week. I was beginning to think that they were thinking that protesters had placed themselves, somewhere in a. In a hole in the Kremlin garden, and they wanted to make sure to seal off the garden long enough, far enough in advance that the protesters would starve themselves to death before their inauguration occurred. And then this was the inauguration of somebody who's absolutely terrified of his own people. So terrified, in fact, that none of them could even be seen along the route to the inauguration.
So if he's terrified of his own people, did he know what happened on the previous day on Sunday? Does he realize that there are people out there that don't like him?
He certainly realizes there are people out there who don't like him. But that's a great question. Does he realize what happened? If what he was getting was official police reports, then he got a thoroughly distorted picture. He was probably told that there were 8,000 protesters there, although it seemed there were 50,000. That's a police leak. The official police estimate was 8,000. The police leak was 50,000. And the organizer's estimate was 100,000. I would say I can tell you it was a hell of a lot of people. It certainly wasn't 8,000 people. I think he was probably told that there was violence. He was probably told that the violence was incited by the protesters. Which I don't think is true. I think that the violence was incited by the riot police. But again, what's interesting is that the violence that took place yesterday, and as a result, about 20 people were injured, at least one person severely, and 620 people were arrested. I mean, this was huge, and this went on for several hours. And that was just history. Today we had a whole new day. What I think was interesting about what happened yesterday was that part of the reason it happened, part of the reason there was so much violence, was that the Moscow police were under pressure from the Kremlin to put down the protests by means necessary. And where the Moscow police actually would have probably done their job and made sure that the protests went off peacefully, being completely constrained and physically, among other things, constrained by Kremlin forces, but ultimately forced to engage in violence.
Well, it seems that Putin's spokespeople are already condemning the violence and saying that this, you know, indicates that the movement has changed. It's no longer a peaceful protest, that there are subversives and revolutionaries. Does that portend to something worse? In other words, this will become an excuse for further crackdowns?
I think that's extremely likely. I mean, I think Putin is going down the road of tightening the screws. And yes, I think we're probably going to see measures, you know, either banning public gatherings altogether or somehow restricting them severely.
Again, I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, a journalist and author of several books. Her latest is The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Prominent activists were, of course, arrested yesterday, Alexei Navalny, Sergei Udaltsov, and, of course, Boris Nemtsov. This has become a ritual, hasn't it? They pay the 1,000-ruble fine, constant intimidation. What's the sense of this protest? Well, give me a sense of the character of this protest, because I'm reading press reports from the BBC and other places suggesting that you have the kind of new nomenclature of this gangster capitalist clique regulated by the KGB that run the country, and then you have the vast sort of detached narod, the rest of the country that's sort of not paying attention, and then you've got a rising middle-class, professional class that's the heart of this protest movement. What's your characterization of the protest movement?
Okay, first of all, this whole middle class, professional class as the heart of the protest movement really makes me mad, and it makes me especially mad after yesterday's protest. And, you know, I'll be blunt, I haven't slept in 48 hours, so I'll be very direct. Basically, what happened yesterday was that, I was among the organizers of today's protest, and sort of I cooperated with the organizers of yesterday's protest. We really thought that it was going to be about 5,000 people, and at least 50,000 people showed up. We didn't know who these people were. They were not, you know, our Facebook friends. They were not the people that we hang out with at cafes. They were people who, a lot of whom, had been from other cities to take part in a protest to use what they perceived as their last chance to tell Putin that he was not their president, that they had not elected him. They were not, the wealthy urbanites from Moscow. They were the really, you know, gritty, ordinary street activists from cities all over the country. And while the Moscow organizers, the prominent people like Nemtsov, Udaltsov, and Navalny, got off with a 1,000-ruble, that's about $30 fine. Several hundred of those people from other cities are still in jails in Moscow, and their families don't know where they are. There are a lot of people running around the city today, trying to figure out who's where and who needs to be notified about people who are behind bars in Moscow. A lot of those people are kids. The two 16-year-olds from St. Petersburg, for example, that we're trying to locate, we know that they were the protesters, we know that they were detained, and then we can't find any trace of them after that. Again, this is not the rising middle class. This is sort of your classic, extremely broad-based street protest. Now, in addition to the 620 people who were detained yesterday, almost 500 people were detained today, and that's not all. I mean, we'll probably pass 500 by the end of the day, because the tensions continue. It started this morning with perfectly peaceful protests. People just went out into the streets. I mean, this is a protest that I was one of the organizers for. And what we suggest that people do is just come out into the streets of the city if they didn't want to get arrested. This was the thing. If you don't want to get arrested, don't take part in the radical protest. Just come out with a white ribbon and walk around. Nobody can detain you for wearing a white ribbon with us. Well, almost 700 people have been detained today for wearing white ribbons on their clothing. Nothing else.
Tell me about the symbolism of the white ribbon.
The white ribbon is a symbol that emerged last fall after the street protests broke out against the rigged parliamentary elections in December. Someone suggested, actually several people simultaneously seemed to suggest that white would be a good color to symbolize purity, to symbolize honesty, to symbolize the inclusion of all sorts of political beliefs. So this is the white ribbon to symbolize the movement for fair elections. We didn't get fair elections. We don't expect to get fair elections. So it's sort of morphed into a symbol of honesty and purity and something that is clearly opposed to what the current regime is.
I imagine, Marcia Gessen, the thing that Putin fears most is a kind of orange revolution in Russia itself.
Right. I mean, we're not going to get an orange revolution because the orange revolution in Ukraine, it refers to the 2004 sustained protest that went on for, I think, 2.5 months that in response to a rigged election of the Ukrainian president. That resulted in a re-election and the election of a popular candidate, but the Ukrainian Supreme Court played a key role in the Orange Revolution. It was when the street protests sort of pushed the issue, the court took it up and ruled on it. And this was possible because Ukraine at the time, even though it had a president with authoritarian tendencies and it did have rigged elections, it still had a parliament that had a discussion going on, and it still had at least a quasi-independent judiciary. Russia doesn't have any of that. All of that has been annihilated by Putin in the last 12 years. So what we're facing is something quite different. What we're facing is building those institutions back from the ground up, trying to build an independent judiciary where it has been incinerated, trying to foment a conversation in parliament where parliament has really grown used to thinking of itself as a rubber stamping body. It's not going to be as fast as the Orange Revolution. I do think it's going to be as effective, and I think it's going to be quite as catastrophic for Putin, but it's going to take at least a couple of years.
And it will be what I guess is called people power. This is completely bottom-up and spontaneous, and it's across all classes.
Absolutely. That's the key thing to understand about Russian protests, and that's why this whole business about the middle-class protests makes me mad. Because what we've seen time and again, and what we especially saw yesterday, is that it is people from all walks of life, from all over Russia, from all income levels, and all ages, who are really fed up with living under this regime.
But they're facing another 12 years of increased authoritarianism, cronyism, systematic corruption, and drift towards, something that resembles a sort of nationalism, fascism. I don't quite know how to characterize it, but give us your worst fears, Marcia Gessen.
Whether Putin sincerely believes that the KGB was the best thing that was ever invented, and what he really wants to do is turn Russia into the KGB, which means a closed system that is vertically integrated, that is ruled like a military organization by one person. He's made great strides in that direction. He's really made Russia resemble the KGB in some key ways. But he no longer has the cooperation of the Russian people. So, like any closed system, it looks very solid, but inside it's extremely fragile. We've seen dictatorships collapse all over the world. It always seems like they collapse in a single moment. That's not really how it happens. What happens is that the bottom of the pyramid is sort of taken out by people who suddenly realize that the regime is no longer legitimate, or was never legitimate. That's what's happened in Russia. The process of sort of taking apart the lowest rung of the pyramid so that the top collapses will take a little bit of time. But that process is inexorable. It's underway, it's unstoppable, and it's going to happen.
But when you say he's turning the country, or has turned the country, into the KGB and will do so even more in the 6 to 12 years that he's got ahead of him, it's a kind of KGB incorporated, isn't it? It's a KGB with capitalism. And I'm wondering, is there any vulnerability in that regard, in the way that capitalism is changing China as well? Or is this can he control capitalism and therefore regulate them and make sure they behave?
Well, Russian capitalism is a very particular sort because it's really what we're talking about is oil and gas. And that's a little bit different from manufacturing and from building up a number of different companies and creating a diverse economy, which at some point would probably start to conflict with such a closed structure as Putin has erected. Unfortunately, that's not the case for a country that survives solely on oil and gas exports, which is a fair characterization of the Russian economy at this point.
And Putin pretty much controls it, doesn't he? Through his cronies.
And Putin pretty much controls it.
Yeah. So
the flip side of it is that oil prices aren't going to keep growing forever. I mean, yes, we said that 7 years ago. We said, you know, we couldn't imagine that oil prices were going to be $50 a barrel forever. Now, they've gone up as high as $120. But still, they're not going to keep growing forever. At some point or another, they will at least stop growing. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Russian economy will stumble badly.
So what about the people that showed up to celebrate Putin's inauguration? Gorbachev was in the audience, along with Silvio Berlusconi. Of course, they're friends, a strange liaison there. Is there any possibility of some international ostracism? If Putin is sensitive to how Russians feel about him, I assume he's very sensitive to how the rest of the world sees him. And your book is very courageous, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, in as much as it finally tells the truth and cuts away all of the equivocation about who this man really is, a small man who's basically a petty thug who has managed to take over this, you know, destroy the promise of freedom in a country that has not experienced too much freedom in its the last God knows how many years.
Right. Thank you. That was exactly what I was trying to say. The inauguration is the guest list is interesting to ponder because, of course, you know, the foreign heads of state were not invited, and I think part of the reason they weren't invited was because of the pervasive fear of what would happen on inauguration day, because of the fear of protests, and because of a less sort of well-formed fear, just a general fear and anxiety. So the only people invited were, at the time, French President Sarkozy and Berlusconi and former German German leader Gerhard Schröder. Schröder and Berlusconi came, I believe. Sarkozy had instead of. Other than that, it was the Russian elite and that points to just how isolated the Russian regime has become and how isolated the country has become, how provincial it has become. Now, is Putin sensitive to what the West thinks of him? No, but not to an extent. I mean, he wants to be feared. He wants to be perceived in ways that Soviet leaders were perceived, as somebody to be contended with and somebody who's big and scary. But at the same time, he also keeps his money in the West, as do all of his cronies. And so if Western leaders not only start to look at what's really going on in Russia, not only start to criticize what's going on in Russia, but start instituting legislation that bans entry and that freezes the accounts of corrupt Putin officials, that, I think, will be a very effective measure.
Well, Masha Gessen, I'm very grateful that you're able to stay up so late to talk to us and to give us a first-hand account of what happened both on Sunday and today with the inauguration, the protests on Sundays, and continuing today, and the inauguration of Putin and the extent to which you were one of the organizers of these protests. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and we're very grateful.
Thank you very much for calling.
Again, I've been speaking with Masha Gessen, who's a journalist and author of several books. She's contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta, and Slate. And she is the author of the new book, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections. She is the author of Party Politics in America, the Major Political Parties Text, now in its 15th edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Professor Marjorie Hershey.
Thank you.
And are we looking at the twilight of Senator Richard Lugar? Is he going to be the last of the moderates?
Well, he may not be the absolute last of the moderates. There may be another buffalo out there on the plains somewhere, but it certainly looks as though we're very likely to see the defeat of Senator Lugar tomorrow.
And what is the reason for this? Is it because of money, because the Tea Party candidate is getting all this outside help from the Club for Growth and other super PACs?
And I think it's never one factor. There are a whole series of factors. Senator Lugar is certainly very widely respected in the state of Indiana, but he has been representing the state in the Senate for six terms now. That's really an extraordinarily long period of time. He's 80 years old. He has not lived in the state since he was first elected. That's been about 35 years. I think that the outside money has clearly made a difference. There's been a tremendous amount of money that has been put into this race by the Club for Growth, by Freedom Works, by a variety of other groups. And Murdoch himself raised a fair amount of money within the state.
And Murdoch is his opponent. Secretary of State?
He is the state treasurer.
State treasurer, sorry. And give me a sense of his Tea Party credentials then. Why is he considered the Tea Party candidate?
You know, it's very difficult to tell exactly what is the Tea Party these days. He is considered the Tea Party candidate because of the fact that he is extremely conservative. He is a strong fiscal conservative to the extent that he wants to cut out such government spending as the Environmental Protection Agency and a whole series of pretty far right-wing stands. But it's very difficult to tell what the Tea Party is in Indiana right now. The Tea Party movement in 2010 had at least a fair amount of grassroots support. It was probably unlikely to keep it because grassroots movements just tend to die out unless they have some central direction. And what the Tea Party is in this race, quite frankly, is the centralized big money sources of 527s and super PACs from Washington, D.C.
Well, the Club for Growth, of course, have an enormous amount of influence, not so much because its leader, Grover Norquist, has any great charisma. He's something of a joke. He's often referred to as Liberace with a wife. He conducts these strange little soirees with the sort of the Washington closeted gay mafia, and so he's quite a insignificant character, but he has enormous amount of money behind him, big corporate money. And that's the real agenda here is why does Karl Rove, and Karl Rove's been more pragmatic. You know, he supported he was against the Tea Party witch candidate in Delaware and the one in Nevada that Harry Reid defeated. So this time around, they seem to be wanting to go with a Tea Party candidate, which could run the risk that the Democrat might win in the fall.
Well, I think the Democrats are thrilled that Murdoch is doing so well, and as they should be. It clearly will be much easier to defeat Richard Murdoch. I'm not suggesting that it will be easy, but it would be a lot harder to defeat Senator Lugar in the fall. Senator Lugar gets a lot of support from independents and from Democrats. Richard Murdoch will not. That probably means that, at minimum, the National Democratic Party can expect to force the Republican Party nationally to put more money into this race in the fall than it would have otherwise chosen to do, and that it would have had to do if Senator Lugar had been running again.
So, again, I'm speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University in Bloomington, and she's the author of Party Politics in America, now in its 15th edition. What is the reason, though, for Senator Lugar's demise? I mean, obviously there's some obvious things on the surface, that he's a policy wonk, not a political tactician, and apparently he has not listened to the political pros who said, you know, you've got to come out strong early and not let these Tea Party people get the traction. They've pointed out what happened to Bennett in Utah, et cetera. And Lugar's messaging has been all over the place, whereas Murdoch seems to have stuck to fairly core themes. But the argument that the senator's long tenure has caused him to lose touch with his state and his conservative principles seems to be working, particularly when Lugar was forced to admit that he no longer had a home in Indiana. I mean, why didn't he just rent a room?
I think that Senator Lugar has not been terribly concerned about the strategic aspects of Indiana politics for quite some time. I think he has had his heart in foreign affairs. He has spent a great deal of time working in a bipartisan manner with relatively moderate Democrats to try to decrease the stock of nuclear arms around the world, to try to do a lot of good in terms of foreign policy. That's what's important to him. What is not important to him is spending an awful lot of time doing the kind of grassroots work in Indiana that would have gotten him reelected again. I think that he certainly was aware, after Senator Bennett was defeated in Utah by very conservative forces, Senator Lugar was certainly aware that he would be the next to be targeted, along with Orrin Hatch and some others. But I just don't think it's in him to try to do anything necessary in order to do the kind of grassroots organizing that would have been required.
Well, you would think, though, that Senator Lugar would have gotten the message that after the 2008 elections, Indiana's 11-person congressional delegation consisted of five moderates. Lugar, the moderate Democrat Senator Evan Bayh, three Blue Dog Democrats, Representative Joe Donnelly, Brad Ellsworth, and Barron Hill. And now there's only Donnelly and Lugar left.
Yeah. I think that what we're seeing is not necessarily a long-term trend in Indiana. I think that in 2010, there was clearly a move to the right, and it seems to have been able to sustain itself for a whole series of reasons, not all of which are due to its great strategic wisdom, but due to a number of circumstances that have come together. I think that Indiana is a state that probably will go Republican again in the fall, but it's not as far right as Richard Murdoch is.
So what kind of a chance then does Donnelly have, the Democrat who is going to run against, presumably run against Murdoch? And some people seem to think that this will be a repeat of what happened in Delaware with Christine O'Donnell, and in Nevada with whatever her name was.
Well, I'm not sure that Richard Murdoch has witchcraft in his past. That certainly would make it a lot tougher for him, but he would certainly be favored, there's no question, in the Senate race in the fall. Nevertheless, I think that it all really depends on the extent to which the economy improves during the course of the next 6 months. There is a strong conservative Republican candidate for governor, Mike Pence, who is a member of the House of Representatives currently and is leaving the House in order to run for governor. He has done very well in his own congressional district in Indiana. He has more name recognition than his Democratic opponent, or his likely Democratic opponent, does. If it turns out that Mike Pence is able to get an awful lot of Republican votes out, then that will certainly help Murdoch. But there's no question that the Democrats will be much enhanced in their likelihood of taking over that Senate seat if Mr. Murdoch is the one who wins the primary.
And could Richard Lugar try a third-party run like Lieberman did when he lost the Democratic nomination and ran as an independent?
I think that would happen when pigs fly, Ian. This is not who Senator Lugar is. He has been a very loyal party representative over the years, and I just simply can't imagine him running as an independent. If he did run as an independent, I suspect he'd win.
Well, but at this point, he's encouraging Democrats to vote for him, isn't he?
Yes. Over the weekend, campaign has been calling Democrats and independents. Indiana's primary does allow you to state at the polls which party ballot you would like to accept. Now, if you are a Democrat and you state that you want a Republican ballot, there is likely to be a Republican local official present who can challenge your ballot, but that probably isn't very likely to happen very often. So the percentage of crossover voting in most elections is relatively low, maybe at most about 10%. At the moment in the polls, Murdoch is at least 10% ahead of Lugar. Now, it's difficult to trust polls in primary elections because the turnout tends to be very low, and a lot of people tell poll takers that they are going to vote in the primary, so their vote is counted in the poll, but in fact they don't show up to vote in the primary. So we can't be sure that those primary polls are accurate, but it looks as though Murdoch has enough of a lead that it would take one dickens of a crossover vote to make a difference.
And why are they more motivated to vote for him and not for the favorite son?
Well, I think that an awful lot of people on both sides of the aisle in Indiana have had a great deal of respect for Senator Lugar over time. He's behaved in a very bipartisan way. When Evan Bayh was in the Senate seat that is now held by Dan Coats, Evan Bayh and Richard Lugar had a joint constituent service or casework operation, even though Bayh is a Democrat and Lugar is a Republican. They considered it more efficient to work that way, and I think that got him a great deal of credit with a lot of independents and Democrats in the state.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. It does seem like the statesman will lose and the conservative will win. And again, I'm just absolutely amazed that statesmanship has become a dirty word in the United States, but perhaps it's only in Indiana.
Among some people in Indiana, please.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
I don't mean to tar you with that broad brush. Thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she's the author of Party Politics in America, the Major Political Parties Text, now in its 15th edition. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Sister Simone Campbell, who has recently been singled out for the Pope for criticism because she has been promoting radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith and not pushing church teachings on abortion, contraception, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood.
Nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Keep talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do.
Make a little space, make a better place, heal the world, make it a better place, for you and for me and the entire human race. There are people dying, if you care enough for the living, make a better place for you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. She was recently singled out for criticism by the Pope for what the Vatican believes to be the promoting of radical feminist themes incompatible with Catholic faith, specifically Network's ties to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and its support for President Obama's healthcare reform push, as well as its perceived failure to promote church teachings on abortion, contraception, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sister Simone Campbell.
Glad to be with you.
And clearly this is a battle that has more to do with politics than faith, and I take it it's a battle that is not welcome. This feels awfully atavistic to me.
Well, I must say it was a total surprise to us that we at Network, we're a national Catholic social justice lobby. We work on issues that affect people who live in poverty, and we work to advocate for them in the halls of Congress. It was a shock to us that our work would be singled out from Rome by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It certainly appears to be politics in our civil setting, not politics in the church setting, though those are probably at play too. But it was a real stunning event for us.
And of course, Pope Benedict used to be the head of the Doctrine of the Faith, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, under the previous Pope.
That's correct, yes.
So the target, though, is the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which was formed in 1956 at the Vatican's request, and it represents more than 80% of the 57,000 religious women in the United States. It seems to me that that's the majority, isn't it?
Oh, it's definitely the majority of women religious in the U.S. that they represent. And the other group, the Congregation of Major Superiors of Women Religious, broke off from the LCWR as part of the result of the Vatican II changes. They preferred not to make as many of the changes as the group in LCWR did, but over the years there's been greater connection and conversation between the two groups, so that I think women religious on the whole in the United States, while we may dress differently among each other, we really hold sacred the call, what we see as the call of Jesus to come follow me and serve the gospel. I mean, that's what religious life is about. That's what we do. And quite frankly, to have the Congregation for Doctrine of the Faith say that we spend too much time serving the poor, I take that with a great deal of credit and high marks. I wear it as a badge of honor because that is exactly what we're called to do.
But also, it seems somewhat surreal to single you out for criticism about not being sufficiently zealous about contraception when you've taken a vow of celibacy. I mean,
well, you're right on that one. It is very odd to me that our church leadership, who also takes a commitment to celibacy, continues to be more concerned about non-celibate practice of sex than some of the other issues that we really need to address in our society. So it is, I do laugh that going to the nuns to talk about contraceptive is a bit odd, but be that as it may, we do work for the needs of all people who live on the economic margins of our society, and yes, indeed, it's women, too, who do use contraceptives that we are, that everybody should be able to use their conscience properly formed. That's what we're for.
But there's clearly a connection, is an ideological one, that the more contraception that's available, the less abortions that are likely to be performed?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly that can be seen as a connection. I also think the other factors that affect abortion rates, we know from studies, is economic supports for pregnant women. And if women have economic opportunities and the capacity to get prenatal care and to be able to raise their children with support for childcare, for well baby clinics, those kinds of things, women are more likely to choose to keep their babies. That's one of the reasons why we supported the health care bill that had the Pregnant Women Support Act in it, which provides support for pregnant women who are in those very difficult moments of choice, but who can then say yes, they can see a way clear to keep the baby. And it's that support that I think is really important for us as a society to be in favor of.
Again, I'm speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. Now, you brought up healthcare, which is really the reason why I wanted to talk with you, because, first of all, the President's healthcare reform, Affordable Care Act, was in jeopardy, as you well remember. It barely passed, and the key vote was Congressman Stupak, and I believe the nuns weighed in on and persuaded him. He was wavering under pressure from conservative circles. So there has been a history of support for healthcare reform from the nuns, but there's equally been a history of a lot of the bishops going after it. One bishop, for example, it's surreal that you should be singled out for criticism when a bishop has been able to call the President of the United States, compare him to Hitler and Stalin. Which
that
is,
was shocking. That was shocking.
Really shocking.
Shockingly inappropriate. But the role that we did with healthcare reform, as I will always be proud of it for our nation, because what we did was we wrote the letter that Catholic sisters signed on to, the leaders of the various women's religious congregations signed on to. And I've been told by many Catholic Congress members that they were able to vote for healthcare because of our letter of support. The USCCB, the bishop's office, continued to be opposed to the bill because they feared that there might be a penny that would be spent on abortion in the bill. Two federal courts now have made the determination as a matter of law that there is no federal funding of abortion for abortion in the bill, but yet the bishop's office persists in saying that there is or that there might be. I can only think that they've got another political agenda that's further that they're not willing to accommodate what is the truth about the bill. Our work in the bill, yes, we did affect Congressman Stupak's vote, but we affected a number of congressmen's votes. And it actually turned out not being as quite a squeaker vote as we thought. There were several votes over the majority. So our support was really important. President Obama said we were the tipping point. We allowed it to happen, and I'm very proud of it. It's good for families. It's good for small business. It's good for children. It's good for women. It's good for our nation to have healthy citizens. And the scandal that we have 50 million people in this country, the richest country on earth, without access to health care is a scandal and, I believe, a sin. So this is a significant step forward. Not perfect, not the end of the story, but it's a significant step forward, and we need to applaud it.
Again, I'm speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic Social Justice Lobby. But as you know, Sister Simone, we have all of the work that you and others and the President have done. And of course, you have to go back to various presidents have tried to get a national health care of some form in, going back to Harry Truman, Richard Nixon, and many, ironically, Teddy Kennedy towards the end of his life regretted not having picked up on Nixon's initiative, saying, you know, they wanted
who knew it was going to be this hard?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's been a massive, long struggle. And now it's passed, and guess what? The Supreme Court is poised, at least to my mind, and a number of other people seem to think it's almost inevitable that they will strip out the heart of the bill. What's your sense of how this ruling will come out in June?
I don't know how it's going to come out in June. I'm a woman of prayer, and so I'm praying fervently that sanity will prevail. From my perspective, sanity requires that we extend coverage to people in our country. But I do know that the bill has already dramatically changed the shape of healthcare in our country. We're moving from a fee-for-service where your doctor gets paid for more tests and more MRIs, those kinds of things, to a value-based medicine where what works, what is the best outcome, what has the best likelihood of working. That shift is huge. We also know that the cost of healthcare coverage in our country has been out of control. It's been exploding, and that it's containing costs that are really important. The Republicans in Congress want to limit some of the mechanisms to limit costs, especially for Medicare and Medicaid. The fact is, limiting costs, having review, being value-oriented is really important. Another thing that's really important is the whole idea of having a medical home, that we need to integrate services. That also has already made a significant shift. And I don't believe we can go back, that the country will allow us to go back to denying health care for people who are sick just because they're sick. This whole idea of a private insurance companies can gain profits while denying coverage is wrong. And I believe that the people of the United States will not stand for that, no matter what the U.S. Supreme Court does.
But again, it seems to me that these struggles are not over faith, but over politics. And I'm astounded at how the conservatives on the Supreme Court, who are likely to vote to strip out the individual mandate, which is the main sort of mechanism by which the bill works, because you have to expand the pool in order to cover the poor. And
you have to expand the pool in order to cover those who are the high-cost sectors and to extend coverage. That's it. Some of it, it's not so much the people who are poor as it is the people that are the working poor, just above the poverty line, who don't get health benefits through their employers and yet are working full-time. It's that expansion of care for the working poor that is at the heart of this. It's a way of saving business money, and business is catching on to it. When you've got the Ford Motor Company coming out in support of this, in order to try to trim costs, then you know, hey, business is catching on. That's the piece
right.
that we have to make clear.
But, you know, whether it was made clear in the arguments before the Supreme Court by the Solicitor General, I think not. I mean, the point that I find extraordinary is that the objections that the conservative on this court may well have, and after all, they're all of the Catholic faith, it seems to me about abstractions, about doctrinal arguments that have little to do with humanity. And that's what concerns me, is that there's a kind of connection here towards this kind of conservatism in the Catholic Church, as well as the conservatism as reflected by the Supreme Court. And the objections to health care are dressed up in all kinds of legalistic prose, but at the heart, it's really about helping people, and if you strike it down, you're hurting people.
Amen. Amen. I'm with you. I totally agree. I think maybe getting one of the Supreme Court justices to talk to you about what in God's green earth are they up to might be your next show. But the piece that's so important that people need to know is that we have benefited already from the Affordable Care Act. I mean, I've got workers in, we have young people who come fresh out of college who come and work for us for a year, and all three of them continue on their parents' medical coverage because of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it's very significant. Small businesses benefit from this bill. Because I just got in the mail from our accountant that we're going to get, we pay our health insurance for our employees, and we're going to get an $8,000 rebate to help us pay for it for 2012. That comes out of the Affordable Care Act. There's so many benefits in that, that the sound bites of negativism have really trumped the fabulous, effective quality of the Affordable Care Act, and we need to preserve all that we can, because health care will not be the same in our country, no matter what happens in the Supreme Court.
Well, Sister Simone Campbell, you are making the case which I wish the Democrats and the President was making. I mean...
Well, I've had some suggestions that I run for Congress recently, so I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is... It's the story that needs to be told, and if our politicians aren't telling it, then your listeners have the responsibility to do it. I have the responsibility to do it. This is a time that is too serious for our nation. We are facing some really horrendous issues in our country. The economy is struggling. We need healthy people. We need healthy citizens. We have to let people know the benefits of this bill. It has made all the difference for so many people, and we must speak up for it. We have to speak out if the media sound bites aren't doing it for us. That's why I'm talking to anybody I can, like you and your listeners, so I hope other people will speak up too.
And again, I'm speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. Recently, Congressman Paul Ryan spoke at Georgetown University, where preceding his talk, the faculty wrote a letter castigating him, saying that he was trying to make the argument that Catholic teaching and Catholic doctrine supports his kind of draconian approach to government, and to which the President of the United States has referred to his budget, the Paul Ryan budget, which is being adopted, of course, by the Republicans and by the Republican candidate for president, Mitt Romney, as nothing but thinly veiled social Darwinism. And preceding his speech at Georgetown, both the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and the faculty at Georgetown suggested that Paul Ryan's doctrine was less influenced by Catholic teaching and more influenced by Ayn Rand. He has since distanced himself from Ayn Rand, even though on the record there's an enormous amount of him promoting her strange teachings. Do you take Paul Ryan at his word that he, in fact, has repudiated Ayn Rand?
Oh, I have no idea if he has or not. The fact is, he doesn't understand Catholic social teaching, so apparently maybe he doesn't understand Ayn Rand. The fact is that the bishops and network and the faculty at Georgetown and thinking Catholics around the country know that his principle of subsidiarity is not rugged individualism where everybody does it by themselves. What subsidiarity means is that we as a society come together as a society and decide together how we move into the future around tough problems. And we do it at the level that is most able to solve the problem. He then gives lip service to the idea of solidarity, which he never even really references. Solidarity is the balance to subsidiarity, and while those are big fancy words, all they mean is yes, we're individuals, but we're individuals in a social setting, and we are what in my faith we call one body. We are one body in this globe of ours, and as one body, we are interdependent. Interdependent beings need to solve these problems together. If my pancreas decided it was going to go off on its own, it would really upset my stomach, and it wouldn't be a good idea. We know people die of those kinds of complications. Well, our society is dying from this very sort of rugged individualism, which does not take into account the fact we are one body. We have very serious problems. We need to solve them together in civil dialogue, civil discourse. We can disagree, but let's find the way through, starting with our values and building up from that. That's the way we create a more perfect union, as our Constitution says.
Well, just in closing, Sister Simone Campbell, when you say we're all one body, the Catholic Church itself appears to be divided and pretty much along male and female lines, at least in terms of the hierarchy. In much of the struggles, and recently the Pope came down against female ordination, and you, of course, and were singled out for as I mentioned at the top, for criticism by the Pope. For not being sufficiently zealous in terms of promoting the Church's teaching on abortion, contraception, objection to homosexuality, and the all-male priesthood.
So, I know. That's what they said. The fact is, we at Network, we're a political lobby. We work on issues that are on Capitol Hill. Our mission is to work on the economic justice issues. That's our mission. That's why we're bold, we're brave, we're brazen when it comes to economic justice. We're Catholics. We're of one faith. But I must point out, as you have already, is that this is really about politics. And we, at least in my family, and I think in every family that I know, there's differences about politics. We can still have one faith and have political differences. The effort is, how do you deal, how do you engage those differences? And that's where we have a disagreement. From it appears from the doctrine of the faith's perspective, the way you deal with disagreement is that you silence it. And from my perspective, the way you deal with disagreement is that you get together and talk. They've never talked to us. They've never asked us about what we do. They've never engaged us in any form of dialogue. And for me, that says, we have a lot of work to do to try to really be this one body and try to model how Jesus did. Jesus talked to everyone, whether he agreed with him or not. So that's how I try to live, just faithful to the gospel.
But it's just extraordinary to think when you mention silence. I mean, it was silence over the pedophilia has led to the enormous payout of money. I mean, think about what you could have done and your organization could have done with all that money.
Oh, my gosh. Don't even tempt me with that. But even worse, the silence created anguish. Because I'm a lawyer, and I used to do family law, and I worked with victims of abuse. And one of the hardest things for victims of abuse is that they have a hard time believing it really happened. And when our church was silent in the face of that abuse, the anguish that it created for victims, that was a double wrong in my view. First they were abused, and then the reality was questioned for them by the silence. And the anguish of that was wrong. The money's wrong. The use of money is wrong. But even worse is what it did to people. That's horrifying. It's horrifying. And I think some of this effort may be an effort to try to distract people from that anguish. But the fact remains is that there were serious sin in the way people have been treated and abused in our church. And that just brings tears to my eyes to think about it and to know that that anguish continues. It's wrong.
Well, yeah, I don't mean to continue it, but it does continue. That's the part that I find extraordinary, that it's still not being solved.
I know. And until we do serious repentance, we're in deep trouble, in my view. But I also hold out hope that Jesus calls us all to conversion. So I hope in this process, all of us can be better, deeper, stronger in faith and in living the love that Jesus calls us to, not the condemnation. Live in the love for the Lord Jesus Christ. That's what Paul says. I'm with him.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sister Simone Campbell. Again, I've been speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. She was recently singled out for criticism by the Pope for what the Vatican believes to be promoting the radical feminist themes incompatible with Catholic faith, specifically Network's ties to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and its support for President Obama's healthcare reform push, as well as its perceived failure to promote church teachings on abortion, contraceptive, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30.